It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Now I'd like to take a moment to courageously offer my regrets for certain events that may have happened. Rest assured, I'm not the sort of person who would do that sort of thing, and I'm very sorry to anyone who was oversensitive or foolish enough to misinterpret my actions or intentions in a negative light. Please know that my anguish over these events outweighs the impact on anyone who was harmed by those actions and who, when you think about it, probably had it coming. In closing, I express my willingness to put it all behind us by graciously accepting your forgiveness. Okay, that wasn't an actual apology for anything in particular. It was a demonstration of some lessons from our next guests, lessons in how not to do an apology. In their blog and in their new book, they say apologies are good, they're valuable, they help rebuild social ties if we do them better than I just did. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find it difficult in your life to apologize and to phrase it the right way? What were you taught about apologizing growing up? How do you teach your kids about saying they're sorry? What's the best apology you've ever gotten? What's the worst? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel are the founders of the website Sorry Watch, which analyzes public apologies, and their new book is called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. They're both authors and writers. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
And
that was a great apology.
I was going to say, Marjorie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. That was one of the worst apologies I've ever heard.
I was going to ask. I really tried. I drew real life lessons from your book. Marjorie, how does that stack up in the world of bad apologizing?
That was just gorgeously terrible. That hit just about every bad point other than I'm not perfect and I'm on a journey.
I am on a journey. It's true. Now, Susan, on a serious note, part of the point in tracking apologies and writing this book is you see a lot of benefits to good apologies. What do apologies do for us as people, as a society?
I think both as people and individuals and as a society, a good apology leaves us in better shape than we were in before. It not only heals relationships, but it leaves them stronger.
Marjorie, what led you and Susan into tracking apologies, both at SorryWatch.com and now with this new book?
We are both journalists and we love to research and we are longtime friends. And I used to live in San Francisco where Susan still lives. And now I'm in New York, although I have lots of Wisconsin family. And when I moved, Susan had this great idea that we could collaborate on this subject that interested both of us. And so we started doing the blog in 2012. And then in 2016, I think apologies really came to people's attention and the forefront of more people's interest when we had a president who had an innovative new take on apologies and not apologizing. And then we thought we could go into some research and really explore the notion of why apologies can be really courageous, difficult, vulnerable, brave acts in a book. So we did a lot more research and here we are.
And Susan, I wanted to ask about that. This idea sometimes that, well, I don't want to apologize because I don't want to admit wrongness. It makes me seem weak maybe if I apologize. Make the case for what Marjorie just said, that apologizing can be a sign of a certain strength.
Well, when you apologize, you make yourself vulnerable. You put yourself in a one-down position, something that we just instinctively avoid. But if you can push through that, actually apologize, you will look stronger. You will look more like a grown-up, more like a good person. And so ironically, if you go through and you let yourself look weak, you'll end up looking stronger.
Talking to Marjorie Engel and Susan McCarthy about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. You can call in with your questions, your experiences with apologizing or lack of apologies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll spend some time on bad apologies. But Marjorie, can you start us off with the basics of what the elements are in a good apology?
Yeah, we say that you can apologize really well in 6.5 easy steps. They're easy to say, but psychologically, they can be really hard to do. Number one is you use the words I'm sorry or I apologize. You don't talk about regret as you did in your terrible apology in this, that opened the segment. Number two, you name the thing that you did. You have to say it. Number three is you show that you understand why what you did was bad and hurtful. Number four is don't make excuses, which is all too easy to do. You can explain what you need to explain, but be really careful not to turn that into making excuses. Number five is say what you're doing to ensure that this won't happen again. What steps are you taking? And number six is if you can make an offer of repair of some sort, which isn't always a possible thing to do, but if you can make reparations, do that. And the six and a half, the all important half step, is listen, let the other person have their say.
Susan, how do we get ourselves in the right mindset? You know, I know when I make mistakes and offend other people or, you know, just harm people in my life, I get defensive, right? I don't want to admit that I'm a bad guy. How do I get myself from there to a position where like, well, wait, I did do something that, hurt somebody in my life. How do I get there?
Well, one thing that you can do is you can practice. You can practice on little things. Oh, I'm sorry. The salt is in the kitchen after all, and kind of get past the barrier of doing that. But one of the things that I think we're doing with the website is we give a lot of examples of bad apologies. In my research with learning, animal learning, in fact, I discovered that one of the ways that animals and people learn things is by watching others be taught. And so looking at bad examples of apologies, which we have lots of in the book, some of them pretty funny, is a really good way to learn how to do a good apology.
Marjorie, in the book, you share what the two of you view as a good apology. This is superstar Lizzo apologizing. She used the word spaz in one of her recent songs, a word used against people with disabilities often. Can you share some of that apology with us and why you found it was thought it was a successful one?
Yeah, it was interesting. Both Beyonce and Lizzo had both used this word that is a slur against people with disabilities. And I just like, Lizzo is just no nonsense. She went in, she got out, she didn't turn it all about, this, I'll read it to you. This is from her Instagram. It's been brought to my attention that there is a harmful word in my new song, Girls. Let me make one thing clear. I never want to promote derogatory language. As a fat Black woman in America, I've had many hurtful words used against me. So I understand the power words can have, whether intentionally or in my case, unintentionally. I'm proud to say there's a new version of Girls with a lyric change. This is the result of me listening and taking action. As an influential artist, I'm dedicated to being part of the change I've been waiting to see in the world. XOXO, Lizzo. So, you know, it's a little bit self-aggrandizing, but you're allowed to do that when you are Lizzo. But, you know, the important thing here is she changed it before she even apologized, right? Like an apology isn't just empty words, it's taking action. And that's really the impressive thing that she did. And she wasn't defensive and she owned it.
Susan, where do people start to go wrong? Now, and let's not talk about celebrities here necessarily, but in our daily lives, what are some of the most common pitfalls when we try to apologize but don't hit some of those good notes?
Well, one of them is not even saying you're sorry, saying I feel bad about that. And then there's a real temptation to go into how bad you feel. Oftentimes we summarize some of the bad apologies as sorry if, sorry but, sorry you. Sorry you is where you turn around and accuse the other person of being so annoying you had to do the bad thing.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. I went through a 12-step program, actually several of them, and you know, I was a very active participant. I went through counseling and you know, the 12 steps make amends. Well, I tried to make sure I did that, and I you know, it wasn't near as bad of an experience I thought it was. But the flip side of that is, in recent years, I've had three people make these kind of, I call them fake apologies, you know, and your guest, you brought it up, you know, I'm sorry, but, or you this, or, and one fellow, I was sitting with my girlfriend, and he came up to me to apologize. And then when he got done, he started walking away. He says, "Well, I don't know what I'm apologizing for, but I guess I'm sorry." And I turned to my girlfriend. I said, "Well, he just took it all back. It would have been better if he would have said nothing." Yeah. You know?
Randy, I want to ask, in that 12-step program, this is, I think, something a lot of people have experience with. Like, when you did the step where you're making amends and making apologies, like, did you feel like, I'm ticking off a box here? Or did you come in with a sense like, hey, I did this person wrong, and I'm really taking a shot and making amends for it?
Oh, I felt horrible about the things, you know, but, you know, I think it's also, you need to be self-reflective and really do a really strong looking depth into, and putting yourself in the other person's shoes too. And I think that's really important. And it seems like the apologies I mentioned, they never once tried to put themselves in my shoes. And I just thought that's kind of an odd thing, you know.
I gotcha. Randy, thank you so much for sharing that. Marjorie, Randy gives us a lot to work with there. What do you think?
First of all, congrats to Randy for, you know, doing recovery and for having all of this really good insight into apologies. One of the things we point out is that not everyone is as good at a lot of times when people begin a 12-step program, they're super excited to go out there and make amends and, you know, make a fearless moral inventory. And that often means apologizing without thinking about the impact of your apology on the other person. So if you're approaching someone who hasn't heard from you in 5 years and your relationship may have ended poorly because of whatever drove you into recovery, think for a minute before you go off like a fire hose with your apologies. And it sounds like Randy really did that he kept at top of mind the fact that apologies are about the other person. And then when someone says to you, "I guess,"
Thanks for sharing your experiences, Randy, on both sides of apologies. We're talking to Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel about their new book. It's called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever gotten that apology that just made things worse? Have you gotten an apology that changed your life maybe for the better? Do you have difficulties apologizing, even when you know maybe you should? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel. Their new book is called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies, chock full of advice on how to make a good apology and examples of how to make a bad one. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about apologizing? Are you good at it, or is it hard for you to do? If so, you are not alone. Have you ever gotten a good one or a bad one? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Pat is with us in Middleton. Pat, hi.
Hi. So on the infrequent occasion when I've had to call a company over something that wasn't quite right, in my estimation, it seems like there's this probably written by lawyers or risk managers type of reaction that I get, and I wonder if others do too, which seems like it's built to deflect liability and just simply say, it doesn't matter really what the issue is. I'm sorry you feel that way. And then we never get really to the what is the issue. It's more about how they're sorry, how I feel. It really is a why bother kind of conversation, and maybe that's the whole point. I don't know. But I was wondering what you think about that.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. And Susan, you've got a whole chapter on corporate apologies and non-apologies in the book.
Yeah, I think Pat is really onto something. I think that they are reading from scripts. I have definitely had that experience myself. I remember once dealing with an airline where the perfectly nice person on the phone was apologizing repeatedly for the confusion. And there wasn't any confusion. It was a deliberate airline policy to try and get me to pay extra for my seats. But she just had to read over and over, sorry for the confusion, sorry for the confusion. And other times they'll say, you know, we wrote about a dental practice that kept saying, we're sorry you feel this way. Well, yeah, you know, my mouth won't close properly. And my other dentist says it's an outrage. So those are scripts that companies give to their employees who are forced to read them. They don't make people feel better. Like Pat, we can see right through it. And it doesn't get rid of liability.
Pat, thanks a lot.
Oh, go ahead. A poor apology is actually worse than no apology. And when people, you know, people are determined to believe that this isn't the case. But a 2006 study by the Harvard Hospital System looked at the fact that good apologies do not increase the risk of, say, malpractice suits. And there is so much evidence that bad apologies actually cause them. And some malpractice lawyers think that two-thirds of malpractice suits are actually because of the failure to take responsibility and apologize and communicate openly, and people get vindictive.
Thanks a lot for that call, Pat. Liz joins us now in Sister Bay. Liz, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had a situation when my mother-in-law did something not only to hurt myself, but my place of business. And she admitted she had done it. And then, you know, I expected an apology. And the apology was what you were just speaking about with the other guest. And she said, I am sorry you feel that way. But she did not say that she was sorry for what she had done or admit that it was wrong. And this was back in like 2021. And I'm just wondering, I still have problems like trying to let it go. And I'm just wondering how to move on.
Liz, thanks a lot for the call. Marjorie, first of all, in many situations, maybe where we should give an apology, you talked about this in the book. We don't see ourselves as the bad guy. We come up with reasons why we weren't wrong in the first place.
Right. Like, I'm sure your mother-in-law has decided that there were really good reasons that she did what she did. And again, as I just said, with, you know, on a corporate level, a bad apology is in so many ways worse and more hurtful than no apology. And I'm really sorry that that's what you got. I wonder, I don't know what the caller's relationship with her mother-in-law is like. I don't know if you have the kind of relationship where you can sit down and say, look, I'm still really hurting over what happened. And I would like to talk to you more about it. And I would like you to address, and then you say the X, Y, and Z. And, you know, you might want to do it in a letter because people often have a little more time to process and are a little less defensive when they have a little bit of distance rather than being cornered. But I don't think the caller should feel bad about feeling bad because that's what a bad apology does.
Thanks for that call, Liz. We are talking to Marjorie Engel and Susan McCarthy about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. Back to your calls now. Beth is with us in Mequon. Beth, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a dear, dear friend who was a friend for probably 30 years who got mad at me for I don't know why. She never would tell me. She stopped completely talking to me. I've tried calling. I've sent her letters. We 4 years ago, we moved out of the town that we lived in. Now, this week, her husband died, and I would really like to send her a sympathy card. I don't know if I should apologize again in that sympathy card. I don't even know if she'll read the sympathy card. I feel bad. I don't know what I did. How do you apologize for something you don't know what you did?
Beth, thanks for the call. Susan, any thoughts for Beth?
Beth, I really feel for you. That is so hard. I will say that I think it's appropriate to send her a sympathy card. And in the sympathy card, don't bring up the apology or the mystery about what the apology is supposed to be for. That would be a separate conversation, which you may or may not be able to have. So I would send a sympathy card, you know, with, you know, maybe some memories of her late husband. And then if you can still try in a separate conversation to say, you know, I really feel bad that we're estranged and I feel like I did something, but I don't know what it is. Can you help me figure it out?
Beth, thanks a lot for the call and good luck. Alicia joins us now in Milwaukee. Alicia, hi.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Alicia?
I just wanted to say that I'm in retail pharmacy, and a lot of times people come to the pharmacy after maybe getting a not-so-good diagnosis, pretty bad news, and maybe feeling sad and sometimes angry, and they blow up because one prescription may be there and not another that the doctor said that they would send, or maybe there's something wrong with the prescription. So I have the prescription itself, but there's a problem with it. And so people get very angry. And I have had people call after they leave the pharmacy, call back and apologize. So I just wanted to say that those apologies do mean the world.
Alicia, thanks a lot for the call. And Marjorie, that takes us to a good point to end on. Leave us with some hope for what we can do with a good apology.
A good apology can mend fences. It can strengthen relationships. We have a post on our website about kintsugi, the Japanese art of fixing cracks with glue and gold. And a thing becomes stronger. The cracks don't disappear, but the thing is stronger and more beautiful after a fracture.
Marjorie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Susan, thanks for being with us.
You bet. That was great.
Been talking to Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel, founders of the website Sorry Watch. They joined us to talk about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, any bookworm might tell you that the book is always better than the movie. How could a film ever capture all the nuance and detail you get on the page? Well, our next guest, who reads and writes about books for a living, says that some movies just outshine the books that they're based on. We're talking about movies and TV shows adapted from books, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you like to read the book first before you see its film or TV version, or do you go back and read a book after you've seen it as a movie or TV show? And what are some of your favorite movies and TV shows based on books? Are there ones you wish would be turned into a movie? Are there ones you've regretted the movie version of? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Olivia Rutigliano is the associate editor of the Crime Reads section and senior film writer at Lit Hub. She's also a PhD candidate in entertainment history at Columbia University. Olivia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. There's a lot of challenges that go from taking a book, especially a beloved book, and turning it into a movie. What are some of the pitfalls that a really good adaptation can avoid?
This is a great question. I think we've been struggling to answer that for many decades. I think the first thing is to weigh the question of narrative fidelity. How important is it to include every minute detail, or is it more important to derive elements from the essence of the work on the whole and transform it into something new? I think a good adaptation often walks the balance between the two while understanding that a new medium like film or TV is not going to be able to do everything that the original book or source material does and work within those boundaries.
In a recent feature at Lit Hub, you shared some of your personal favorites. I want to give a listen to one. I mean, a lot of people think of this as one of the best movies of all time. Here's a taste.
Now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, give me justice. But you don't ask with respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me Godfather. Instead, you come into my house on the day my daughter's to be married and you ask me to do murder.
All right, great movie, and you say a much, much better movie than the book. How so?
Well, I think The Godfather, the book, which is written by Mario Puzo in 1969, it's a great book. It introduces us to the Corleone family, and we will always be grateful to Puzo for doing that. But I think the screenplay of The Godfather actually provides an edit of the book that gets us a more economical and very charged version. And Mario Puzo co-wrote the screenplay, which he based off the book, but he co-wrote it with Coppola, who had his own thoughts about how to mold it into a movie. And the two of them edited the original source text together. And that's why I think it works well. It has the true essence of the book through the author's involvement, but it also has a sense of where to cut and where not to cut from an outsider's perspective.
Now, I got to admit, I've never directly read the book, but I double checked the story with my mom. She was reading The Godfather when she went into labor with me.
Oh my God.
So I figure I must, like, I like cannolis, but I think that's all I've taken away from it. So is it, if I like the movie, do you think it's worth it for me to go back and actually read the book myself?
This is a good question. I mean, I always think it's worth to read the book, if only because it enriches the experience of watching the movie to know what was included and what wasn't. I have a similar thoughts about Jaws, which I think is a much better movie than it is a book. I apologize to Peter Benchley. but I always think that reading the book can't do you wrong.
All right, here's a little listen to Jaws, because that was another one you talked about in your piece.
Yes.
Shark! The shark!
Michael's in the pond.
All right, a little taste of the ominous music there. Now, if I'm not mistaken, once again, the author, Peter Benchley, was involved in writing the screenplay?
Yes, he was. Peter Benchley co-wrote the screenplay for Jaws with Carl Gottlieb. And the thing about the book Jaws is that it tries to do so much, and I don't necessarily think it pulls off everything. But the movie was whittled down to a really fantastic three-act structure. There's clear character development, and a lot of the murky stuff that the characters deal with or are imbued in those characters in the book go away. Like in the book, Matt Hooper has an affair. Matt Hooper's the character played by Richard Dreyfuss. He has an affair with Chief Brody's wife, and he's actually not a great guy. And I won't tell you what happens to him at the end, but I mean, he is governed by hubris so much. And paring that down and having him be Richard Dreyfuss's sort of nerdy scientist who's able to advocate for the shark without getting in the way of Chief Brody's personal life and impeding Brody's own arc is, I think, a very smart way to trim that character down.
We're talking about book to movie adaptations or book to TV. Olivia Rutigliano is with us. She's written about this and many other topics. You can find her work at Lit Hub, and she's a PhD candidate in entertainment history at Columbia University. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite book to movie or TV show adaptation where they think they got it right, maybe even better than the book? Or was there one that you were excited about and it let you down? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Olivia, here's one you recently wrote about, a long-awaited adaptation of a Judy Blume book, the classic Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. A half-century wait for it to be turned into a movie. What was it worth it? Was it worth the wait?
Oh, it was. It was wonderful. I just saw it a few days ago, so I'm really able to talk about it. It's fresh in my mind. Yes, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret was written in 1970. It's about a young girl, an 11-year-old, who moves from New York City to New Jersey. And in her new school has a new group of friends who are very worried about growing up or if they're growing up enough. And a lot of the book is about Margaret's own experiences, understanding herself, understanding her body, her body's changes, but also her relationship to her parents and religion and God, and most dramatically. And these are very, very weighty themes, especially for a book that's aimed at preteens. And so Judy Blume did not sell the rights for 49 years until she found the right people she felt would adapt it with respect and make a progressive, thoughtful adaptation out of it. And she found the right people in Kelly Freeman Craig and James L. Brooks, who made the new movie. And it manages to keep the reverent, respectful, but also funny, curious tone of the book without sacrificing any of the important themes or the really useful work that it does in representing girlhood and all of the things that go along with it.
Okay, now, I mean, I grew up reading Judy Blume. This is a cherished memory, those books, for a lot of kids. Were you nervous about a movie having a go at this one, even with the Judy Blume seal of approval on it?
Oh, I was so nervous. My gosh, every time a childhood adaptation gets turned into something, I freak out. I was also nervous about last year's Catherine Called Birdie, which is actually a very similar book, very similar movie. It's also about a preteen girl coming to terms with things, especially about her own status and her body, etc. But that takes place in the Middle Ages, and Lena Dunham adapted that one. Just like when I showed up to the movie theater to see Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I was almost shivering. I was so nervous. But this one turned out to be really wonderful. And one of the ways that it was wonderful was that it wisely understood that not only children were going to watch this movie, the book might have its main audience in 11-year-olds, but the movie is going to be seen by a lot of people, including their parents, who take them to it, or older siblings, younger siblings. So this one actually had wide multi-generational appeal, and it cultivated that by expanding the plot to include a lot of detail about Margaret's mom, who is played by Rachel McAdams. So the two actually become parallel figures in this movie, and it's a really nice way to modernize it and update it, but also cater to an audience who might be moms, preteens, somewhere in between or elsewhere on the spectrum.
We have many callers. Let's bring on Don in Union Center. Don, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just, I think in general, a lot of the time, the book is better than the movie. But and one quick example is I'm originally from Trenton, New Jersey, and I really got a laugh out of the Janet Ivanovich, Stephanie Plum books. And I never saw the movie, but I heard that was a dog. But as far as movies better than books, I've always liked Dr. Zhivago, and then I read the book, and I thought the book was way too much stuff. The movie was a lot more streamlined, a lot more focused. Just the book was real complicated, if you want to say. So anyway, that's just the biggest example in my mind. Dr. Zhivago, I thought, was a lot better than the book.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Don. And that's kind of the same premise, Olivia, you were talking about with The Godfather. It takes, maybe it streamlined it from the book to the movie.
Yes, I think so. Although Dr. Zhivago might actually be longer than The Godfather. So, and having never read the book, Dr. Zhivago, I wonder how long that must be, actually. But yes, I think that's very similar.
Thanks a lot for that recommendation. We're talking about movies and TV shows that are better than the books they're based on. Olivia Rutigliano is with us, associate editor of the Crime Read section and senior film writer at Lit Hub. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about movies and maybe TV shows that are better than the books they're based on. Olivia Rutigliano is with us, associate editor of the Crime Reads section and senior film writer at Lit Hub. You can join in with your suggestions or anti-suggestions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Barbara is with us in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What do you got for us?
Well, a book that I wouldn't consider a great book, but it was a very pleasurable read, was Where the Crawdads Sing by Della Owens. And I thought the movie version enhanced the book. I thought the two should be one read and the other watched.
And what was it about the movie that you liked even better than the book?
It fleshed out some of the characters that the book kind of left a little bit more. I don't know what the word I'm thinking of is.
Sort of background characters, maybe.
Yeah.
Interesting. Barbara, thanks a lot for sharing that. That's interesting, Olivia, because in this case, you know, a couple we talked about, Godfather, Dr. Zhivago, or caller thought, hey, it took out some extraneous stuff. It streamlined it. Sometimes people are liking movies better because it fleshed out some of the stuff that was left unexplored in the book.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? I mean, do you think that's a common approach?
That's a very good question. I definitely think that sometimes when we read a book, we want more from it. A wise adaptation might give us a lot more to work with. I think one of those examples might actually be William Goldman's The Princess Bride, a book which is excellent, but a movie that knowingly expands certain elements while also maintaining pretty tight textual fidelity. I think sometimes one of the issues is knowing when to stop adding things. When we're turning books into miniseries, how many seasons should we play with? How many seasons should we add on if the first one is successful? Questions like that, I think, should govern these conversations. Sometimes less is more.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to give a listen to another movie you wrote about. This is a clip from Tim Burton's 2003 film, Big Fish.
They say when you meet the love of your life, time stops. And that's true. What they don't tell you is that once time starts again, it moves extra fast to catch up.
Sounds like a Tim Burton film. It's based on the novel by Daniel Wallace. The novel, I guess, is a tribute and reaction to The Odyssey and James Joyce's Ulysses. What is it about that one that made the movie better than the book to you?
Well, Daniel Wallace's Big Fish is a great book. It's a novel about a man's relationship with his father, and it is wonderful. However, I saw the movie first, I will admit, and I was so enchanted by Tim Burton's particularly surreal realization of that. Tim Burton is suited really well, I think, to movies that have a hint of realism, but tip, you know, into fantasy or wild adventures. Not too much. I don't want to be taken away to a fantasy world by Tim Burton entirely, but I want the real world to be injected with something magical by Tim Burton. And it's like a picaresque story. It's about this young man getting to know his father through a lifetime of his father's stories. So the flashbacks that take us to these many adventures as they're narrated by the character of the father, who is played by Albert Finney in the present day and who's played by Ewan McGregor in flashbacks, get to be visually full of the kind of possible exaggeration that, you know, all the really good storytellers we know inject into their stories. So the way that the film is handled visually and sonically pairs really well with the figure of a larger than life raconteur or narrator storyteller who regales us and who you wonder might not be telling the truth, but you don't care. So I thought the visual way Tim Burton was able to navigate that was really masterful. That's what made it special.
We've got some more recommendations from our listeners at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Jerry in West Bend. Jerry, hi.
Hi.
I
wanted to tell you, Rob and Olivia, that this is a wonderful idea for a program. I have been a voracious reader for my lifetime. And one of the books I read was Papillon, The Butterfly. And I read it probably 20 or 30 years ago. And a few years later, I came across the book, and I was very disappointed.
Across the movie, you mean?
I came across the movie.
Okay.
I went to see the movie because I had been I had enjoyed the book so much. And it turned out that what they did is, in the movie, they had the main character have events that happened to four or five different people in the book.
Oh.
All happened. Character.
Jerry, thanks a lot for that story. Have you had that experience, Olivia, with, you know, that movie you were anticipating from a book you liked, and there was some kind of decision like that just ruined it for you?
You know, one thing that I'm thinking about is actually the new Great Expectations series that aired on FX/Hulu. The Great Expectations is a novel I absolutely love, and I've reread many times over the years. I'm a big Dickens fan. And that adaptation was startling. It was startling how much was moved around, condensed, and straight up invented. To the point where I didn't recognize it anymore.
Wow.
So I wouldn't say it's the exact same thing of having multiple characters condensed into one, but it did condense, let's say, 300 years worth of action adventure into the experiences of a single character who often doesn't deal with many of those things in the book. So I was a bit unmoored, let's say, by that decision.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Jerry. We're talking about book to movie or book to TV adaptations. Olivia Rutigliano is with us, and we're looking at the ones where the movie did it better or maybe the book did. Back to your calls with Susie in Williams Bay. Hi, Susie.
Yeah, I'm going to say To Kill a Mockingbird.
Are you saying movie better than book?
I think they're both great.
Oh, okay. Oh, that was the one you liked the book and the movie didn't let you down.
Right. I haven't read the book since high school, and I have seen the movie lots of times on DVD, and I think they're both excellent.
Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that one. Olivia, she likes them both, though it's been a while in the book. Is that one a movie you want to weigh in on?
Yeah, I think those are actually frequently referenced in conversations, articles, where the book is just as good as the movie. Movie is just as good as the book. They're both masterpieces. And of course, you know, Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch is one of the most indelible figures in cinema history. An actor, Harper Lee, initially didn't want to play Atticus Finch because she thought he was too dashing, too handsome. And it took some convincing, allegedly. So sometimes even the author is a bit dubious about some of the ways that a text will be realized in real life. But I agree. I think the book and the film both are extraordinarily impressive and very effective in what they set out to do.
Thanks a lot for that call. Maurice joins us now in Madison. Maurice, hi.
How you doing? So
good.
My movie is On the Beach with Gregory Peck and Ava Gardner and Fred Astaire in a dramatic role. It's about the surviving people after a nuclear war, and the only people left are in Australia, and they're dying off, too. I didn't read the book, but my point is that it's like comparing apples and oranges because it's a different experience. The emotion that was brought by those characters, I don't think the book could have done that. I remember the author's name is Neville Shute.
Neville Shute, yeah.
And I guess it's a good book. I'll have to read it finally.
Maurice, thanks a lot. I got you. Thanks a lot for the call. I've read the book. It's a great book. Really bummed me out. I didn't want to live through that experience again, honestly.
Yeah.
Olivia, you were nodding along. I think I heard on some of what Maurice had to say, though, on the apples and oranges there.
Yeah, I think they're extremely different. I think the book, On the Beach is a post-apocalyptic movie from the late 50s. And I think in the novel, there's the war starts without any nation being at fault. I think it's more about the destruction of the world and the survivors as opposed to a specific global conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that differs than in the book. I think it differs than in the movie. I think the movie is very much about the global politics that lead up to the war and the destruction of the world.
Interesting. Thanks a lot for that call. Olivia, I was just thinking you mentioned authors who don't like where the movie is going. I visited Anne Rice's grave in New Orleans earlier this year. She famously hated the idea of Tom Cruise playing her main character and then took out a full page Variety ad saying, I love Tom Cruise as my main character. thoughts on that one as we wrap up?
Yes, I think that's one of the famous conversion stories of an author initially not liking the character and then going to like it. I mean, when you write a book and you see someone else realize it, you can have many different reactions. I think Emily St. John Mandel, the writer, has said that she believes other people might actually have better versions of her story than she does.
Wow.
But that's not necessarily shared by every author. And sometimes when you put your heart and soul into a book, you create a character who is, you know, so captivating. It's very hard to see someone you didn't initially envision in that position. I don't know. I know one of the great adaptations is Field of Dreams, which is not on the list and which is I forgot to include when we were doing our roundup. I didn't think of it and I should have. But W.P. Kinsella, the author of the book Shoeless Joe, on which Field of Dreams is based, actually based the character of Ray Kinsella on himself. I mean, how does an adaptation process work when someone's doing it, when the character is based on you?
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Olivia Rutigliano. We've been talking about films and TV shows adapted from books. This is Central Time.